Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're just a mere couple of weeks away, at least in my school district, of kids going back to classes or, you know, whatever we're going to do popping up. And yet you look at Georgia and I look at this Cherokee school district down there, you know, something like 1,200 people now in quarantine. And the one girl, you know, aptly put it, you know, they used us as guinea pigs because this is really the first test on how, you know, people are going to go back to school, how the infection rates could happen, how it could spread. And within a couple of days, they shut the school back down again. And that's my fear. My fear is we're going to just open this up too quickly like we did with our economy. And we're going to expose our kids to a bunch of this stuff and ultimately their families as well. And we're going to end up closing again anyway and have wasted all of the time that we could have had to actually get something right. It's insane. It's crazy, but it's sadly where we are. That's why I've asked Arthur Steinberg to come talk with us. Arthur's the president of AFT Pennsylvania. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So, you know, I'm looking at this, you know, as a parent of, you know, two kids now in school, I'm like a lot of people, you know, what are we going to do? How do we keep the kids safe? I'm seeing all these stories. Not good.
Now, listen, I think one thing I need to reiterate and emphasize, which I've been saying all along, is our membership desperately wants to be back in school teaching their kids. Okay, nobody wants that more than they do. However, it must be safe. And the first requirement before we open and can give them, you know, a robust educational program is that we can assure parents and staff members that everybody is going to stay safe. And I think that's the first benchmark we have to hit.
And I don't know that you can make that actually happen, especially given the fact that, you know, we've had, you know, class crowding for years. You've got, you know, especially where you're at in Philadelphia, you've got school buildings that are old and, you know, HVAC systems that are antiquated. You've got all of these challenges that, you know, right now in the middle of this pandemic are only magnifying how underfunded our education system has been to this point.
Very true. Listen, Rick, we are in the midst of really, you know, a triple crisis. There's the pandemic. There's the economic crisis that it has caused. And then you also have the systemic racism, which is really illustrated by that underfunding that you talked about. So putting all those together, you have a very, very untenable situation.
Yeah, and also, you know, you think about, you know, all the stories that we've heard and we've talked about on this show over the years, you know, of teachers, you know, basically all of the responsibility falling on the backs of teachers. In fact, I spoke with a New York City teacher yesterday who said, look, you know, where they're talking about reopening the schools there, you know, teachers are going to have to buy their own PPE. You know, they get maybe one pack, but, you know, they it's going to roll onto the back of the teachers. And again, this is another one of those moments where we've really just kind of, you know, screwed this whole thing up.
Yeah, well, that's why, you know, in our plan, which was pretty detailed, we insist that the school districts provide, among other things, the PPE. And I think it's important for me to let the public know, because of these shortcomings that you just cited in our building, in particular, you know, the ventilation system, the lack of movement of fresh air, the PPE is the last line of defense. And that, you know, the masking and the physical distancing will go the greatest way towards providing a safe environment. Without that PPE, you're going to have lots of people getting sick, community spread, and someone's going to die.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you go back to this, and, you know, all of us want to get back to some bit of normal. All of us want to get back to, you know, life as it used to be. And you know, we've got really at the top a president who's saying, you know, things are great. In fact, you know, as I pointed out yesterday, you know, we're at nearly 170,000 people having died from this, and he's saying the numbers are great. You know, nobody thought we could do what we've done, and maybe he's right. I never thought that we could kill 170,000 people and think that's great.
Listen, I think, you know, you mentioned the president, his policies, lack of leadership, and the rhetoric coming out of the mouth of the Secretary of Education have just contributed to the crisis and helped to confuse the public. These buildings now, you must really convince people that they're safe before anybody is going to be comfortable walking in the door.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Here's the other part of this. And this is the response I get back from a lot of parents who are going, look, I need to send my kids to school. You know, my husband works. I work. We need somewhere for the kids to be. We can't just leave them at home to their own devices. You know, we've got a society right now where, you know, sadly, both parents are forced to work, sometimes two jobs, sometimes three. And the schools, like it or not, have become that place where kids go. Granted, your learning and education is important, but, you know, it serves as a function of you know, childcare.
Yes. Yeah, but we need to recognize that just because they need somewhere to send them, you don't want to send them to somewhere that's unsafe. You wouldn't send them into a building where everybody had tuberculosis.
No, you're right.
Just to say that you need chakra, you need that. All the more reason the government, and in particular the federal government, has to develop a coherent policy and provide the resources so that schools can function and we can open the economy back up.
No, that's where the answer for me is. Look, you know, at the end of this, it comes down to we've not had a very good policy at the very top. I think Governor Wolf has done a reasonably good job. You know, being right next to New York, we didn't have the massive spikes that I was expecting. We had our problems, but we didn't have the massive spikes that I was expecting. And yet, you know, the governor has just taken, you know, beating after beating. And I'm curious your thoughts or your assessment of how he's done.
Unfairly so. And with the guidance he put out this week, you know, it's really kind of gratifying to see that he is giving more direction, being a little more prescriptive with it, and really saying that these certain benchmarks must be met before you can open school buildings. Listen, I am grateful at this point that I do not live in Florida or Georgia. The way they're opening the schools irresponsibly, the Governor Wolf's leadership and Secretary Rivera has really been helpful and allowed us to convince districts to implement a lot of these safety protocols before they open buildings.
Now, recently, AFT's president, Randy Weingarten, was quoted saying that all options are on the table. And a lot of people, you know, said, you know, safety strikes are a possibility. Is that something that you think is possible?
It absolutely is. Listen, each situation is local. All politics is local, right? Depending on their collective bargaining agreement and the conditions in the school they're in, that is a tool that has to be used. Now, it's a last resort instead of the first. But I will tell you that even before she came out with that, I had locals all across the state calling me and asking me about the possibility of them doing that if, in fact, they felt that their buildings were not safe or their district's plan was irresponsible.
Well, look, at the end of it, you know, sadly, again, the old saying, you know what, rolls downhill. And sadly, again, you know, the safety of our children is on the backs of teachers. And this is, you know, one of these moments where I much more trust my kids' teachers than I do a politician or somebody in D.C. or even in Harrisburg. And I want to know what my kids' teachers think.
Well, listen, I think we've proven over the years that we are the best advocate for the kids across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We have their best interest at heart. We kind of know what's best for them and what works in schools.
So let me ask you this line. You know, let's say you've got kids that are school age, and because you know it all comes back to you know what you personally believe. You know, what would you do? I mean, what's the advice that you'd give yourself if you were talking to you with young children, given the situation that we're in?
Well, first of all, I would assess the community spread where I live. I would go into the district and ask specific questions depending on their plan. I would ask for hard and fast data on their ventilation, the movement of fresh air. If, in fact, they intend to enforce the 6 feet of physical distancing, not where feasible, if they are minimizing sharing of equipment, if they are reducing the amount of traffic, maintaining adequate spacing on buildings, do they have an isolation room set up when kids or staff members display symptoms? And really, what their processes are to ensure that taking all the steps they can to minimize the risk of catching this virus.
Yeah.
Because we cannot falsely tell people that we're going to eliminate the risk, but we have a moral obligation and a responsibility to minimize it as much as possible.
Yeah, I'm in this world of, you know, the reality is if you've ever had a kid in a classroom or somebody brought lice into the classroom and how quickly that spreads, now magnify that by an airborne pathogen and you know, head lice is just a mild nuisance. This could potentially be fatal.
Absolutely. And the spread, and really we have an inordinate number of kids that live in multi-generational families. So, you know, the research now is showing that kids, even though they may not get very sick, and they're getting sicker now as more kids get exposed to it, can take it home and transmit it. And, you know, one of the misnomers is that, well, the kids didn't get sick in the fall. That's because we kept them home. As you mentioned at these schools in Georgia, now that they're being exposed to it, more and more of them are becoming sick.
Yeah, excellent point. So last question I've got, because the option that we're given as parents, and, you know, I've heard this from a lot of listeners who are going, you know, I don't really want to send them back to school, but what they did last year wasn't anything that was really helpful. A lot of parents weren't thrilled with the education that finished out the year. And look, it was a you know, we're in the middle of a crisis. Teachers did the best they could. They learned the system as best they could. Sadly, I don't think a lot of districts took the time that we had over these last couple of months to develop an alternative to going back. So I'm curious, you know, if you're not sending kids back to the classroom, you know, what advice are you giving? Because a lot of people are saying, no, you need to go to these cyber charters. They're great. Only to know that none of them have made AYP and that they're, in my view, fairly terrible.
Now, the cyber charters' performance has been dismal. And they have not done anything in the meantime to improve their ability to deliver an education. Now, hopefully over the summer, the district had some time to plan. They are developing more robust, rigorous academic programs where, you know, better learning can go on. And more importantly, Rick, dealing with the digital divide and making sure that a lot of the kids have not only access to Chromebooks and computers, but internet, and that the speed is enough for them to be able to learn and participate in the educational program at their school. We acknowledge that the digital program last year was not as strenuous as it should have been. But remember, we kind of built a plane as we were flying it.
Right.
And the idea really was to plan over the summer. And listen, frankly, I don't think the district spent enough time doing that. But I know in the areas where they're engaging with our locals and our members, we are working, you know, assiduously to help them develop that and cooperating with them so the kids can learn.
So last question, would you send your kids back to the classroom, or yes or no?
Depending where I am and where I'm located and meeting those criteria that I set for you before, it would have to really be a personal decision folks would make. I can tell you in Philadelphia where I am, I would not. In a lot of the districts across the state, like up in Scranton, I would not. They would have to assure me building by building that it was safe. And the transportation through the community, there's no risk of catching it. So to me, really, the environment is too volatile right now. But listen, they are personal decisions. There may be districts in places where they can spread out enough, where the transmission is low, and they're taking the proper protective measures that they can open school. But that really, we have 501 school districts in the state of Pennsylvania, and that's why you can't make a blanket statement.
No, I hear you. Arthur, I appreciate the time and the information. Always great talk with you.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me anytime.
Anytime. Our good friend Arthur Steinberg, president of AFT Pennsylvania. I'd love to hear your thoughts. What are you going to do with your kids come the fall? Is it helpful to hear Arthur lay out the ideas? You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come the dawn.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We're not going to let Joe Biden and Kamala Harris cut America's meat.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, you go back to It's one of those moments where you go back to 2009, and, you know, I remember, you know, during the 2008 election going, you know, all of the Wall Street criminals who collapsed our economy, who made massive profit off of bringing the country nearly to its knees, I wanted to see them all perp walked. I wanted to see trial after trial of watching these rich guys who gamed the system for their own profit. I wanted to see them locked up. I wanted to see the trials. I wanted to see the whole nine yards. And sadly, sadly, we didn't get any of it. And I'll tell you, that really, really very frustrating to me on so many levels. That, you know, I'm hoping at this moment that if Joe Biden is elected, that we move forward on holding somebody accountable. I'm here to share some thoughts on how maybe that could happen. And, you know, hopefully it does. I've asked Sam Berger to come talk with us. Sam is the Vice President of Democracy and Government Reform at the Center for American Progress. Sam, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
I think a lot of people, you know, who especially a lot of folks on the left who have been watching, you know, the kleptocracy right before our very eyes. You got somebody at the Postal Service who's in charge making tons of money off of other contracts. It just seems like at every turn, we've now turned our government into a money-making operation for a handful of Donald Trump's friends and his relatives. And I think people don't want that, and I think people want accountability at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two things that have been constant in the Trump administration. One is corruption, generally personal corruption by Trump and other high-ranking officials. And the other is an attack on the rule of law, a sense that the Department of Justice should be changed into a weapon to be used to defend Trump's friends and hurt Trump's enemies. And so these are two things that need to be addressed at the same time by the next president. We need to return to the rule of law, and we also need to hold people accountable. And, you know, sometimes people think that there's a tension between these two things, but there really isn't if you do it the right way. Because what the rule of law says is that everyone gets treated the same,
right,
no matter who they are, where they work, who they work for, what their politics are. So it means you don't treat the Trump administration or the officials in the Trump administration any harsher, but it also means you're not more lenient. You don't give them special breaks. And if they broke the law, then they get held accountable just like anybody else.
Which is why Lady Liberty is supposed to be the woman with the scales, supposed to be blindfolded.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the whole, I mean, it's right there in the Department of Justice manual. You're not supposed to let politics interfere. And so that's why the plan that I propose, it's really three steps. Step one, you have to have the new attorney general do a top-to-bottom review of the Department of Justice to identify politicization. Because we know what's happened. We've seen it with Michael Flynn. We've seen it with Roger Stone. We've seen it in a number of cases. But there's no reason to think we know all of it, right? This is just popped up because of the Mueller report or because of investigations around impeachment or other specific whistleblowers coming forward. But given the breadth of what we already know, we have no choice but to assume it goes far deeper and is far broader than what we understand. So step one is identifying it.
Right.
Step two is letting career officials do their job. So this isn't something that, say, the Biden administration should be involved in. The Biden White House shouldn't have any idea what's happening. They should say, you go look at the facts, you figure out what to do, and, you know, we'll find out when everybody else does. Right? And so you let career officials do their job, and if Trump administration officials have broken the law, then they're held to account. If they haven't, then they're not. And then the third step, I think is critical, is that we have to make sure the agencies are also doing an anti-corruption review, because this is way bigger than the White House. There's a culture of corruption that has seeped in to the entirety of the federal government. So each agency needs to do a top-to-bottom review and identify instances of corruption. And where laws have been broken, refer to the Department of Justice. Where they haven't, you know, where agency rules and regulations have been broken, refer to the Inspector General, which is an internal watchdog. Take administrative action, corrective action as appropriate, and provide information to Congress and the American people so we can know what happened.
It sounds like a good plan. The question is, will it happen? I mean, you know, your first part of it is, finding out what we know. I had someone recently tell me, think about what we do know, and then imagine all of this stuff we don't. And, you know, at every turn, every one of these executive orders that he's put forth, you have to wonder, you know, this methane thing. You got to wonder who's filling his pockets on this. I mean, every one of these things that we see, I see a price tag attached to. And that's not how our government is supposed to work.
No, it's not. And the thing that we've seen time and time again is that the absence of accountability is treated as permission to do even worse. That's why it's so critical that the next administration be clear that the rule of law exists right now. The laws apply right now. Even if Bill Barr's Department of Justice doesn't want to enforce them, they exist right now. And if you break them right now, you'll be held responsible, just like if you break them in the next administration or the administration after or the administration after. That's what the rule of law means.
Right.
And so we're going to restore it. Then we have no choice but to look for where laws were broken and hold people accountable. And I think that basic principle, I hope, will carry the day with the next administration, that they'll say, yeah, we have to do this. Now, they shouldn't be, the next White House shouldn't be involved in any way. And in fact, you've seen, you know, Joe Biden say, look, I'm not going to tell anyone to prosecute, but I'm also not going to stand in the way if people need to be prosecuted. And I think that's the right approach to take. You have to let career officials do their job without any political interference. That also means not interfering to tell them, don't look into the past administration. Don't look at this person because they were politically well-connected.
Right, but here's the thing, Sam, and this has been, you know, the problem in this country for a very long time. This isn't just new now. Every administration has, you know, let the last one slide. I think of all the stuff that got us into the wars in Iraq. I think of all of the stuff that, you know, happened with Wall Street. You go back to the Reagan era. And, you know, not looking in, you know, Bush not looking into Reagan or Clinton not looking into both of them. I mean, this has kind of been the longstanding, hey, let the sleeping dogs lie mentality. That seems to be, how things have been. How do you do this in a way, though, that isn't going to seem punitive and political? Because we haven't done this, how does the Biden administration allow that to happen? Because ultimately, he's going to appoint the attorney general, whoever that may be. And regardless of if they're independent or not, you're still going to see this, well, he's Biden's guy or woman.
Sure. One thing I'll say is, I think that you're right. And particularly in recent times, there's been a real concern about actually looking into the past administration. And to a certain extent, rightly so. I will say, take the Nixon example. Everyone points to Nixon getting pardoned by Ford. And, of course, first he had to resign in disgrace. But, you know, a whole bunch of people in Nixon's administration were tried and convicted after that pardon. Close to 50 people went through our justice system during that. So it wasn't that, you know, no one was held responsible. But, you know, I think that you make a good point. And I think it's a real concern. There are good faith arguments for why this is so challenging. But we're not in a situation where we're saying, well, what if we create the precedent of politicizing DOJ? DOJ has already been politicized. The precedent that we're creating is, what do we do about it?
Right.
What do we do when someone abuses authority in this way? And if the answer is nothing, then guess what? The next illiberal politician, the next illiberal party, they're going to do the same thing, and maybe even worse, because we've already seen, in the absence of accountability, people take it as permission to do more, to do worse, to go further. And that's why it's critical. And also, I'll say, it's critical for people to make that case now. Why?
No, I'm right there with you, Sam. I mean, I've been saying for a while, though, my fear is that we end up in this political world of the swinging pendulum. Because I just had this conversation with somebody yesterday who was saying, Trump signed all these executive orders. And I go, well, you remember Obama did it too. And I was against it when Obama was doing it. And Bush did it too. And Clinton did it. There were these executive orders that continue to go forward. And we didn't put up enough of a stink then. And look, Joe Biden's going to do a bunch of executive orders as well. The same thing can happen with the Justice Department. You have these wild swings in ideological, movement, and the rule of law, precedence, standard, whatever, gets lost, and we end up in this world of wild swings politically, dictating our policy, our laws. It's not a good place to be in.
So I agree that having a Department of Justice that's politicized is terrible. That's the problem that we're dealing with, right now. But the solution can't be to do nothing, right? I think the solution is to try and depoliticize the Department of Justice. And you're certainly right that people are going to say, that's Biden's guy in there, or gal, depending on who he appoints, and that this is, by its very nature, political. But they said that when it was Trump's DOJ that was investigating people. I don't think that we can let the bottomless bad faith that we've seen from the Trump administration and its supporters dictate how we try and restore the rule of law.
No.
And so ultimately, we have to go back to first principles. The rule of law means that the law applies the same to everyone, regardless of political position. And that means you don't treat Trump administration officials or former Trump administration officials any worse, but you don't treat them any better. Treat them the same as everybody else. If they broke the law, they have to be held to account.
Yeah, ultimately, this, for me, and I said, back in 2008 and 9, I wanted to see all those Wall Street criminals. I wanted to see them arrested, indicted, perp walked, tried and convicted and jailed. And I wanted it to be done in a very public way so that it was a deterrent to others. This is one of those moments where I think this stuff has to be done in the open air. I think it has to be under the sunshine where everyone can see it so that you can make those assessments individually of if it is political or if, look, these people really did make a boatload of money off of our government. It really was a money-making enterprise, as I said back on Inauguration Day, that this was going to be the most kleptocratic administration in history. And you don't need a crystal ball. You don't need to be clairvoyant. You need to be halfway bright to figure that out. It's who Donald Trump was, and it's who he surrounds himself with. And here we are, 3.5 years later, not surprised, the most kleptocratic administration in history.
Well, and the thing I think that's important is, and people need to realize, it's not just Donald Trump, right? It's a whole administration. The government is made up of a whole bunch of people, each of them making individual choices.
Right.
And if they think they're going to be held to account for what they do, then they're going to act differently. And if they think that they can get away with whatever they want, if the current president says it's okay, then that's how they're going to act. And people look, people understand these precedents. The law means something. And so, right, and not just the law that's written down, but the law as it's applied, what happens in practice.
Yeah, that's true, Sam. That's true. But, I think all of us also believe that there really are still two laws, one for rich people and one for poor people, one for black people, one for white people. I think we've become accustomed as a society for, the scales of justice not being quite equal.
Well, certainly no way would suggest that we currently have a justice system that applies equally to all people, by no means. But I don't think that, obviously, the key is we need to be moving towards a system that is more equal, right? And letting politically powerful people get away with stealing from the government, stealing from the American people, lying to Congress, lying to federal investigators, destroying evidence, doing all these sorts of things, just encourages them to keep doing it. So I think that you're entirely right, and I think there are real concerns about how our criminal justice system applies to folks. But the key is to try and move towards a better direction, right? And you do that by trying to treat everyone equally. So I think in this case, we have to come back. I keep saying it, but it really is that core principle. You don't treat Trump administration officials or former Trump administration officials any better, but you don't treat them any worse. Treat them the same as everybody else.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Because my mind is now spinning around, what a non-politicized Department of Justice looks like. Because for so long, we've had a situation where no matter who's in power, who they choose, the other side always goes, "Oh, this is just political." We heard it with Eric Holder as well. Is there a way to make that office less politicized? Is there a way, to maybe make it not as divisive? I mean, in the old days, you had to get the 60 votes to do we have to go back to that? Do we have to go back to a more stringent way of confirming folks for those positions? Thoughts?
Yeah, so I think we need to separate good faith from bad faith arguments here. So I think there are some good faith concerns, and there are steps that you can do to try and address those. So one great idea is, what's called a White House contacts policy, which basically puts into law, requires basically a recording of every time there's a discussion about a particular investigatory matter, criminal or civil, restrictions on who can talk to who, requirements that it be reported to Congress, so that we can know if these sorts of conversations are happening. But we should recognize that's never going to be enough for partisan elected officials, right? We've seen this already happen. They've attacked Trump's own Department of Justice, right? You can't get any more Republican than Trump's own DOJ, and it's not Republican enough for them. So I wanted to separate those two. So I think there are certainly good faith steps that can be taken, and that's part of the reason that this needs to be wholly driven by career officials. You know, people out in the law enforcement community, lawyers, other people who I think are being honest, when they see, say, on the Roger Stone sentencing memo, that all the career officials who were working on the case wouldn't sign it, that tells us something.
Right.
It tells us something is going wrong. Conversely, if you have the career officials being the ones that are signing it, backing it up, going into court and arguing it, people of good faith can say, well, this means something then, because these folks are there to do a job. They're not there to be Democrats or Republicans. They're there to do their job. And so I think that we can satisfy good faith concerns and should do everything possible to do so. But I don't think we need to be worried about bad faith concerns, because they're going to exist no matter what.
No,
if
it's
not
excellent.
This, it'll be something else.
No, excellent point. And it goes back to, you know, I've always said, you know, I want boring, non-political bureaucrats doing their jobs, career people doing their jobs, which is why I'm against what this administration has been doing in attacking those people and attempting to return to the days of patronage. I have a serious problem with that, because then all of this stuff that we're talking about only magnifies and gets, you know, 10 times worse in a patronage scenario.
Mm-hmm. No, you're exactly right. I think you said this isn't the thing that should be the stuff of press conferences or anything of that nature. It should be the regular way that people do their job. And, you know, in some cases, that'll mean that folks that people really don't like, you know, have real concerns with because of policy differences, well, it'll turn out that what they did wasn't illegal, or there isn't sufficient evidence to bring a case or continue an investigation. You know, and that's the way that it will go. But the key is to let career officials do their job without political influence, to let them follow the facts where they lead, to make the decisions that they need to make based on those facts, to carry out the rule of law to the best of their abilities. That's how the system should work. That's how the system has to work.
Right.
It's incumbent on the next administration to make sure that's how the system does work.
Now, I'm with you. Last question I've got for you then, you know, based on what you just said there, you know, how do you then make it a situation where everyone's not, you know, walking on eggshells, afraid that they're going to be indicted or sued or whatever, you know, for maybe even good faith, honest mistakes, where we just turn into this society of, you know, now we're going to use this as a weapon.
Well, that's why I think, again, you know, folks, these officials look through, right, and have to make calls and determine what sort of rises to the level of being worth bringing charges. And so, you know, when, say, George Papadopoulos lies to the FBI about communications he had with a Russian-linked professor who told him that Russia had the emails and they were going to release them, that's important. But there may be other things that folks do that are technical violations that aren't. You know, and these are the kind of calls that career officials have to make, career law enforcement have to make all the time. And so, you know, I mean, I think ultimately we have to trust in folks to do their job. Basically, if we can't trust the Department of Justice to investigate folks, then what are we left with?
Right.
And I mean, that's really the risk when you have a politicized DOJ like Barr's created. And I do want to, I think this gets to another important point, which is it's the political actors in the DOJ that are causing the problem. The career officials are actually standing up and saying no. Both former and current. We have people dropping of cases. We have people resigning. We have people speaking out. We have thousand former DOJ prosecutors calling on Barr to resign. So they know what's right and wrong. They know how to stand up for the rule of law. And so I think that we should make sure in the next administration they're given a chance to do their job.
There you go. Good stuff. Sam, I appreciate the time as always. I hope folks will take a look at your most recent piece that you've got out, How a Future President Can Hold the Trump Administration Accountable. We'll get links out on social media. As always, good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Sam Berger, Vice President of Democracy and Government Reform there at the Center for American Progress. Again, if you want to check out his piece, we'll get links out on how you can do that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.